So my theme is Second Renaissance. I hope this is a good place to stand. I hope you can see me over here. And it's a bit of a launch talk for our series. So it's going to be a little bit of a general overview of the way that Buddhism and the West are interacting and have interacted. And I had a quote, and the quote which I sent out with the email was from Francesco Varela, who's one of my heroes, a Chilean neuroscientist and phenomenologist who tragically died in his early 50s, about more than 10 years ago now, but did a lot of amazing work of bringing Buddhism and understanding of the mind, Western understanding of the mind together. Very, very interesting. And what he said is the rediscovery of Asian, particularly of the Buddhist tradition, is a second renaissance in the cultural history of the West, with the potential to be equally important as the discovery of Greek thought in the European Renaissance. And in fact, I later found that he wasn't original in that idea. Somebody else talked about the world of literature in particular, and predicted some time ago that there was a sense that with Asian literature and Asian art meeting Western literature and art, that would produce, that encounter would produce, they thought, a second Renaissance. Now, I think it's early days really yet to say whether that is going to be true or not. Maybe it won't be true. But you can see the parallels. Do you know about the history of the Renaissance in Europe? What's said is that back in the, mainly in the 14th century, many of the lost Greek and Roman writers were rediscovered through the Eastern Roman Empire in Byzantium. And so you had, a, maybe to some extent, rather moribund Catholicism governing Europe at that stage, not much in the way of science, not all that much interesting literature or even art in some ways, so I'm sure people would dispute this. But then suddenly there was this great flowering of art and literature and science and culture because these ideas from Plato and Aristotle and the other great Greek and Roman thinkers were coming in. And so the suggestion is that because ideas from Asia, particularly from Buddhist Asia, are so fresh from a Western point of view, so new, in some ways so different to the way we look at things, but yet also they're things that are relevant, they're things that will meet us, that we can get to know, we can understand. And so I really do hope that that will produce a creative ferment. And I hope it does in us individually as well. You know, maybe we won't become great playwrights or great artists, but maybe that ferment of our own background, honouring our background, honouring our own culture and our own tradition, and allowing it to touch the traditions of Buddhism. I think it's going to be really interesting what's going to happen there. So I want to talk a little bit about that in general terms. And I thought maybe I'd start off historically about encounters between the West and Buddhism. And the starting point, it may not be the very earliest starting point actually, but the earliest starting point I've been able to track down is about 300 BC. And there's a new book just recently out, which I've only read reviews of, which claims that one of the great Greek philosophers, whose name was Pyrrho, P-Y-R-R-H-O, Pyrrho, we know he went to India, and he went with Alexander the Great's conquering army. He used to take philosophers along with him. Nowadays they take war correspondents and war photographers and war artists. Alexander the Great took a bunch of philosophers along with him. And one of his pet philosophers was Pyrrho. And Pyrrho was really taken with Indian religion. And according to this new book, he feels he's proved that Pyrrho definitely became a Buddhist in India, returned to Greece, settled there, living a Buddhist life and teaching Buddhism, teaching the Dharma, living a very simple monastic style life. And if you look at the records, which are a bit scarce, unfortunately, of Pyrrho's teachings, it does look quite convincing that he was teaching Buddhism. So that's Alexander the Great. The next thing, this is little flashes, because obviously this is a huge thing, you can write books about it, but the next little flash I want to mention is in Alexandria. Alexandria, the city in Egypt, and if we now move forward a few hundred years to around the time of Jesus or just before, There was a monastic community in Alexandria who were known as the Therapeutae. And according to some people, it was a Theravada monastery. So the Theravada are the so-called southern Buddhist school, now active in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, and so on. And they think that the word Therapeutae is a corruption of the word Theravada. And there's some evidence from the customs, the dress, and so on, that they were Buddhists. And in fact, they found gravestones, apparently, in Alexandria with the Dharma Chakra wheel inscribed on them, you know, the eight-spoked wheel of the Dharma. And I think one of the things that is interesting is that when we look back at ancient history, we're used to flying all over the place and driving, and it's easy to get around comparatively. But we probably think that people were very stuck and isolated in those days. Because after all, you know, from India to Egypt is a big schlep if you're just sitting on the back of a camel, isn't it? It's going to take you a very, very long time. But the fact is, there were links. There were amazingly long links, way up into China, Korea and Japan as well, across into Central Asia, down into India and even through into Indonesia and the islands down there, across into Africa, into the Mediterranean area. And the next one, after the Therapeutae, is Sweden. So in Sweden, and I've seen this myself, I may have mentioned this before here, if you go to the National Museum, or State Museum, I think it is, in Stockholm, and you look in a case, and there's a little Buddha. So it's not particularly surprising seeing a Buddha in a museum, until you read the caption, and you realize that this Buddha was found in a Viking settlement. The Buddha itself dates to about the year 500 or 600, and the settlement was probably a couple of hundred years later. So a Viking had this Buddha buried with him or her in their grave. It's not quite clear who it was buried with. Quite an ornate Buddha with gold and lapis lazuli chasing in the eyes and so on. Quite a nice little Buddha. And the origination of this is the Swat Valley. The Swat Valley is in modern Afghanistan, but it used to be a Buddhist kingdom. In fact, at the time that all this was happening in Sweden with the Vikings, it was ruled by Padmasambhava, the man who established Buddhism in Tibet. And so my fantasy is that a Viking trader met Padmasambhava and was given this rupa, this Buddha statue, as a present. But however, there's not very much evidence of influence of Buddhist values on Viking culture. The Vikings are not well known as being sort of meditators and pacifists. So maybe that particular statue was just an heirloom of a trip. So from the Vikings to Marco Polo. Marco Polo, the great Italian traveller who went to China and also went to Sri Lanka, and he describes Buddhism. He's not really very interested in it. He just calls them all idolaters. But clearly he did encounter Buddhism, and in fact one of the things he tries to do is to tell the Chinese emperor about Sri Lankan Buddhism. Anyway, so that's Marco Polo in the Middle Ages. But then the really interesting stuff starts much, much more recently. And then you have to go back to the early 19th century. And of course, in the 19th century, people started, I would say, before this some people, but particularly in the 19th century, people started genuine objective scholarship, where they weren't just trying to prove that everything was fitted into their own existing preconceptions, as had happened before. But they said, well, let's just look at these things objectively. And of course, India had become a part of the British Empire, or was becoming a part of the British Empire. And so scholars started studying Indian religion and Indian languages. And these are particularly scholars from France and Britain. And in fact, the greatest of the early ones was Eugène Burnouf, who was a French scholar, who learnt Sanskrit, became an expert in Sanskrit. He also learnt Pali, and he translated Buddhist texts. And in 1844, he published his book, A History of Indian Buddhism, which is the first proper account by a Westerner of Buddhism. And in 1852, he published the first translation of the Lotus Sutra, one of the great scriptures of Mahayana Buddhism as well. And he was joined by many, many scholars, particularly in Britain and France, to some extent Germany. And they started translating texts, discussing things, coming up with an image of what Buddhism really was. Now, they generated a particular image of Buddhism, and this was an image which suited the rationalist intellectuals of the time. They rather liked it, but of course what they liked was what they saw in it in particular. It was seen as based on reason as opposed to superstition, without any ritual or devotion or anything like that. It was seen as non-theistic, no belief in God. And so from those people, some Buddhist ideas did enter into the mainstream of Western thinking. And in particular, you'll find it in some of the 19th century philosophers. The most important of those is Schopenhauer. And I think we should be having a talk on Schopenhauer. This sounds really boring, but actually it won't be. It'll be very interesting. We should be having a talk on Schopenhauer and Buddhism in this series, I hope. So Schopenhauer loved Buddhism. He really loved it. He was very keen on it, at least on what he thought it was. And he misinterpreted it as nihilistic and life-denying. And that's what he really liked. And then his, as it were, pupil, Nietzsche, also was very interested in Buddhism. But he was, to some extent, suspicious of it because Schopenhauer had told him that it was nihilistic and life-denying, and Nietzsche didn't like that at all. But nevertheless, he was an admirer of it. So I want to say a little bit about those early impressions of Buddhism, because I think some of the echoes of them still linger from Bernouffe's book and the other scholars of the 19th century and what they saw in it. Some people call it a sort of a Protestant Buddhism. But it's more than that, sort of a rationalist Buddhism. So, yes, it's true, I would say at least, that Buddhism is reasonable, that it is based on evidence. It's to do with what you actually find. It does weaken superstition. It's, if you like, objective. But there's one big thing that one misses out if one stresses the reason, which is that reason is only one of our faculties. The ability to think is only one side of our mind. And it seems to me very, very important that all sides of the mind are involved. And if you can bring the whole of the mind to bear on your experience, then rather than just thinking it through in a logical way, categorizing it all and so on, which is important, and Buddhism does that, but you'll also come to a different kind of grasp of what's going on in your experience. And that grasp is an unmediated, direct sense of this. So, you know, it's happening now, if you think about it. It's happening now if you notice it, which is that we are actually aware. There is actual awareness. There's an illumination, not just from these lights, but there's an illumination from our own awareness that is present in our experience. And in a way, a sort of a confidence in that is the absolute bedrock basis of Buddhism. Buddhism, therefore, is based in your actual present experience. And as you contemplate that experience, you start to realize that the clarity and sharpness and presence of that awareness is not very steady, at least not if you're anything like me. It comes in and it goes out. And we find that it's overlaid by things. And it's overlaid by little bits of panic, little bits of nervousness, little bits of self-obsession. And in traditional Buddhist terms, it's overlaid in particular by clinging, by rejecting, and by ignoring. These three things, greed, hatred, delusion, clinging, rejecting, and ignoring. And that because we're doing this, because of our insecurity in a way, we're not able just to abide in the nakedness of being simply aware. And our thoughts start to come in and they roll over that nakedness. They roll it up into a ball and they make it something that is more attuned to what we think we want now. And so we miss out on that nakedness. But I mention this in respect of rationality because rationality is not the same thing as that basic direct awareness which Buddhism is trying always to foster. And enlightenment is when you have it without any of that clinging and rejecting and ignoring. Yeah. So that's another interesting area to go into, isn't it? Secondly, this thing about not Buddhism being non-theistic, which was attractive to the rationalist scholars of the 19th century, even, funnily enough, the Christian ones, because they had a sense of they wanted to get away from what they saw as old-fashioned medieval style belief in God, and they wanted God to be, in a sense, a very distant figure. And this is true, of course, that Buddhism is non-theistic. It does not believe in if you think of the roles of God, there's no creator. There's no judge of the dead. There's no ruler of the universe. There's no ultimate authority there, and so on and so on and so on. In Buddhism, that's definitely the case. But what one can then miss in seeing it as non-theistic is the fact that absolutely crucial to Buddhism is realizing that our own ego, if you like, our own sense of self, is much smaller than the whole of reality. And so, if you can, you need to set a certain amount of confidence in the sense that we haven't yet grasped what's really going on. We'd need to have that naked awareness active for some time before we'd really have a sense of the whole of everything, in a sense, you know. So it means that there is, in other words, there is a reality which is bigger than us. And of course, for many theists, they would use the term God for that. But from a Buddhist point of view, usually you don't make that personal. It's not a person that can have likes and dislikes, make decisions and judge people, all that kind of thing. It's simply, shunyata, if you like, or tathata, thusness, the way things actually are, is much bigger than our current experience. And I think that's what you can miss if you emphasize the atheism of Buddhism, valid though that is. So that highly conceptual thinking always splits you, is a dualistic type of thinking, and therefore delusive. And a unity with everything is what you're trying to get to. And that unity requires you to have a confidence, a reverence almost, for what is bigger than you. So Buddhism is a bowing religion. It is, you know. It has shrines. It has reverence for the Buddha. It lights candles. It has flowers. That's not a sideline, it seems to me. It's not just for those that are a little bit immature and still like a childish. I don't think so at all. I think it's for the mature. I think it's something really, well, at least I find it something really valuable to have a sense that I am not, you know, within me is not the whole universe. There is something much bigger and something very beautiful. And something very valuable. Now, we're in the 19th century. Later in the 19th century, in a way, the opposite tendency was going on amongst some people to this very rationalist tendency of the scholars. There was a lot of interest in spiritualism, in communicating with the dead, in sort of the belief in magical, mystical figures. Mysterious masters living in exotic mountains in the Orient, in particular. There was a sense of the East as being this wonderful place where very weird and magical things were happening. And so this gave a new image of Buddhism, which was associated with this mysterious Orient. And this image of Buddhism is more romantic, a romantic image. And I use that word partly, like, historically. If you look back at the romantic poets, the romantic artists of the early 19th century, they had a particular view of things whereby, for example, nature, the natural, was very, very important. And the unconscious and the mysterious side of things, wonder and so on, was very important for the romantics. And so at the end of the 19th century, this started to be associated more and more with Buddhism, a oneness with nature, and also saying that nature is where religious experience happens. If you want religious experience, you need to go up to the Lake District and look at some daffodils, basically. Now, again, I find this very interesting. I'll say a little bit more about what it led to, that connection with Buddhism, but I find this interesting because, again, it seems to me it has positive and negative sides. It's not, Buddhism isn't romantic, but yet it does have that important connection with nature and with the mysterious. The other thing that romantics emphasize, of course, is the individual, the importance of individual experience, which, again, you'll definitely find in Buddhism, but it doesn't really sum it up. Creativity is also important for them. So you do have that, the aesthetic response to nature, finding beauty in it, an inclusive response, a compassionate response to all living things, to the trees, to the birds, the animals, and so on. We are part of nature. It's not to be exploited. That is a basic Buddhist position. But there's another sense in which Buddhism goes against nature. Because, after all, nature is our instincts, our evolutionary legacy, what evolutionary psychology tries to tell you. Yeah, that's, for example, you are naturally selfish. You'll go, but after all, Buddhism is saying, no, see if you can overcome self-clinging. See if you can go beyond selfishness. So you do have a sense in which Buddhism reveres nature, but you also have a sense in which Buddhism goes against nature. Okay, Buddhism is indeed centered on individual practice, responsibility, personal emancipation, personal creativity, all those things that the Romantics were keen on in the 19th century. But the sense of the self needing enhancing and protecting and so on, which I've talked about before, this is said to be delusive. And so you're trying to overcome that strong sense of a separate self, a distinction between self and other. You're trying to get beyond that. So in that sense, it's not to do with the separate individual, the lonely individual wandering about, looking at daffodils in the Lake District sort of thing. And in fact, of course, absolutely crucial to Buddhism are two great ideals. One of them is the Bodhisattva ideal, the ideal that a person should be involved with others. You can't be separate. You can't be separate. You've got to be involved with others because others really matter, and dealing with their suffering really matters. And similarly, the Sangha is another great ideal of Buddhism. The importance of being part of a network, that we need that, or at least nearly everybody needs that. Very difficult to be a solitary, separate practitioner. So I hope this isn't too confusing. But anyway, what I'm saying is, yes, Buddhism is romantic, but no, Buddhism isn't romantic. Yes, Buddhism is rational, but no, Buddhism is not rational. Yes, Buddhism is non-theistic, but no, it isn't. And it's very annoying, isn't it, saying that kind of thing. But I think, you know, you have to be a little bit more subtle. Inevitably, people will pick up what they go for, what they really like. And that's what we have all, I do this, I'm sure, with Buddhism, with many other things. I pick up what I like about it, and I just sort of push to one side, ignore the things that I'm not so keen on. Now, the people that really liked this romantic side of Buddhism were the Theosophists. And you may have heard of Madame Blavatsky, who in the 1880s was living in a flat in New York with her pet baboon. And people would come and visit her and be amazed by this incredible... She was a Russian emigre, very remarkable woman, and they'd be amazed by the amazing look in her eyes. And she was able to commune with the masters who lived in the Himalayas, and they would give her messages, you know, and she would write them down at great length. And she was the founder of Theosophy. And some of her followers became, well, actually, she did go for refuge. She took the refuges and precepts. But some of her followers became more explicitly Buddhist than she was. I mean, in a way, she was her own religious leader, I suppose you could say. But one of her disciples, Colonel Olcott, a colonel in the American army, he moved down to Sri Lanka. He designed the Buddhist flag. He even wrote a Buddhist catechism for use in Sri Lanka, and he was there. He was fighting the missionaries. You know, the missionaries in Sri, the Christian missionaries, were trying to convert the country to Christianity, and Colonel Olcott was there, you know, on the side of the Buddhists, trying to save Sri Lankan Buddhism. And related to that, sometime in the 1890s, in Chicago, a great exposition took place, and part of that was an event called the World Parliament of Religions. And this was the first time in the history of the world when representatives from all the main religions of the world all got together and talked to each other, and they gave lectures and they wrote papers, and it was all very, very exciting. And people did start to listen for the first time to genuine committed Buddhist practitioners, because so far everything I've been talking about pretty much has been second hand. It's been these translations of texts that people have brought back. Nobody actually thought of asking a Buddhist what Buddhism really was. And then suddenly at the World Parliament of Religions, these Buddhists turned up And some of them could speak English. And people started saying, well, so what is Buddhism then? You know, is it this? And they'd read Bernouffe's book. And they'd say, no, it's not really that. No, it's not quite right there. I'll mention one individual in particular who was there. This is a man called Anagarika Dharmapala, also a Sri Lankan, a Sri Lankan Buddhist, but very well educated in Western culture, a good English speaker and so on. And he was a great reviver of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, and he spoke to great effect, I believe, at the World Parliament of Religions. And also, on the other hand, you had a number of Zen teachers who came there. And this is really probably the origin of the European interest and American interest in Zen, is that event in the 1890s. Now, in the early part of the 20th century, this fascination of Zen carried on. Partly because in America there were many expatriate Japanese and also Chinese people living over on the West Coast who'd migrated there for work. And the prime mover in introducing Zen to America and Europe was a man called D.T. Suzuki, a Japanese scholar who wrote many works that had a great influence. He knew Jung and so on. And he encouraged a sense of what I would call a romantic Zen, immersed in nature, granting union with the ineffable, and so on. And largely from his influence came the Buddhism of the Beat poets. So we're now moving up into the 1950s, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, and so on, some of them still alive, and they were enamored of particularly this Zen-style Buddhism that they picked up from T.T. Suzuki and his writings. How are we doing? So meanwhile, is this all right so far? Sort of taking you through a bit of history just to give you some background. During the 1950s, what was happening, we go back to the Buddhist East. In particular, one thing that was happening was that the Chinese were taking over Tibet. And one of the responses to the Chinese takeover was that many of the greatest Tibetan teachers fled their country and moved into India and even further afield. And in terms of some of these great Tibetan lamas, great Tibetan teachers, in terms of their interacting with Western ideas, the one I really want to single out is Chogyam Trungpa, who was a youngish man who came first to England, to Oxford, helped to set up Samya Ling, and then moved over to America, where he set up a major Buddhist movement. But the thing about him is he was one of the first people who was really prepared, not just to say, this is how you practice Tibetan Buddhism, you do this, this, and this, but to say, how would this change as it meets Western, in his case particularly, English-speaking culture? How would it change? And he was a very, very creative man in this respect, and I would recommend you reading some of his books. I'd suggest, for example, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, also his autobiography, Born in Tibet, and so on. And he had a big influence, particularly in America, but also in this country. And then he's not the only one, of course. There are many others as well as Trungpa. At the same time, more close to home, the English monk Sangharakshita, who founded our own Buddhist organization, he was fluently translating Buddhism for Westerners. And in fact, there's a whole fascinating set of historical roots for Triratna, the influences on Sangharakshita and the other people that were involved in founding Triratna back in the 60s, which is really interesting, but maybe we could do that some other time. And then also the Dalai Lama, of course. The Dalai Lama is interesting. I mean, much of his mission is to preserve Tibetan Buddhist culture intact, but he's also fascinated by science, the Dalai Lama. And he's initiated this series of very fruitful dialogues between Tibetan Buddhists and scientists called the Mind-Life Dialogues. Look that up online if you're interested. And they've been going now for many years. Every 2 years they have a big conference. And these are big, big scientists who are finding it fascinating, just talking to Tibetan Buddhists, and the other way around as well. Now, over in Burma and Thailand, going back a bit to the 19th century, there was a resurgent form of meditation-based Buddhism, forest meditation-based Buddhism. And this had been growing from the 19th century through the 20th century. And that came over to the West as what was called Vipassana meditation, in various forms, but Vipassana meditation. So Zen, of course, had a strong emphasis on meditation, and so did this Theravada-based strand. And there was also some input from Zen into the mindfulness movement. So the mindfulness movement, which brings us right up to date, originates in this Vipassana movement from Burma and Thailand, but also has input from Zen. It was really started by a New Yorker called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who, again, I would recommend his books on mindfulness. And Jon Kabat-Zinn describes his approach as stealth Buddhism. So he never calls it Buddhism. But, of course, the fact that we know he calls it stealth Buddhism means he's rather given the game away, doesn't it? But he's very keen to present. I mean, he does feel that Buddhism is of great value, and he wants to present Buddhism, but he doesn't want to call it Buddhism. He doesn't want it to be under that religious umbrella, because, quite rightly, he realizes that for many people, immediately that means it's not going to be any of interest. But as a mindfulness movement, he can bring it, as he has in America, into prisons, into hospitals, to be used with people with depression, people with stress, people with pain issues, and all that kind of thing. And we can find that, of course, now in this country and including in this center, that mindfulness movement. I'll say a little bit more about the mindfulness movement in a minute. Coming in from rather left field after the Second World War, and particularly more recently, particularly popular in the entertainment industry, is Nichiren Buddhism. So Nichiren is a form of Japanese Buddhism where your main practice is to chant homage to the Lotus Sutra. And you simply chant homage to the Lotus Sutra, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. You do it out loud, you do it communally in groups. Very simple practice and very popular with many people. I'm not sure to what extent it's really yet engaged with Western culture. I mean, they still chant in Japanese, for example, and even have the Lotus Sutra on their shrine. They don't have a Buddha on the shrine. They just have a page of the Lotus Sutra. But in Japanese, even in Japanese script. So maybe there's a bit more to go with that. I don't know, you know. But anyway, they've been very active and very successful. So if I was to complete the picture and bring it all up to date, I'd have to be very complicated, because I'd have to go through all the different Buddhist movements that are now active in Europe and America. Some of them very faithful to their particular Asian Buddhist roots. Some of them trying to develop new forms of Buddhism for the West. A very interesting area. But I think that's enough of the history. I'll say a little bit now about influences from Buddhism to the West. If we look at what are those influences, because if it is going to cause a second Renaissance, well, how is it? What sort of things, what sort of effects is it going to have? And for me, the most valuable contribution Buddhism can make in the West is not so much the philosophical ideas or the artistic forms, the aesthetic forms and influences. It's more offering a path to people that faces all these dissonances, all the injustices, all the problems of life, and offers a broader, even liberating ways of approaching one's experience. So this means that maybe, first of all, at least for me, probably the most interesting influences from Buddhism on the West, or potential influences, are to do with one's experience, one's mind. In other words, in a way, that's broadly in the field of psychology. And in my opinion, Buddhist psychology is much more sophisticated than the kind of psychology we have so far in Western universities. Western science is miles ahead of any Buddhist science, if there is such a thing, which there isn't. But Buddhist psychology, I would say, is ahead of Western psychology still. But yet it is influencing it now quite profoundly. So what sort of contributions? Understanding better how the human mind works. We can find it out through Western approaches, but we can also find it out through Buddhism. Expounding positive psychology, not just pathological psychology about the problems that people face, but positive psychology about human potential, about positive mental events, and the promise that one can actually change. One's experience is not stuck. Seeing that one can be moral and spiritual without the need for religious authority. I think that's quite an important contribution, psychological contribution for people. There is something beyond oneself. But yet, Buddhism is anti-eternalist. There is something, but it's not a fixed verity. It's not a truth that is always there. Also, Western psychology already has a version of non-self. You go way back to William James in the 1890s, he's already saying there is no core fixed selfhood in the human being. But I think Buddhist analyses can really help that discovery that's already there in Western psychology. Maybe James himself, but incidentally, it's another topic. He may have been influenced by Buddhism in saying that. Also showing a viable alternative to materialism and to nihilism, to belief that really nothing matters apart from one's own basic gratification. I think Buddhism offers an alternative to that. It shows the importance of views and the danger of literalism. I think this is very important. I think often we're trapped in our views, our opinions, our perspectives, and we take them too seriously. And to be able to hang more loosely from your opinions and views is really liberating, really valuable. Skillful and unskillful instead of bad, sin, disobedience and their opposites. So in the West still we do tend to have that sense of, oh dear, I'm a bad person, I'm being naughty, I'm being sinful, I'm being disobedient to somebody who's telling me what to do. You know, this sort of a parent figure. And Buddhism says, no, that is not the appropriate dichotomy. The dichotomy is between skillful and unskillful. And trying to understand the difference in that ethical approach, I think, is a valuable contribution. Consciousness evolves. So the discovery in the West of evolution extends not just to the way that animals have evolved to produce human beings and to produce other modern animals, but also it extends to the possible evolution of consciousness within one's own lifetime, one's own experience. I've also already mentioned this one, to bring in the possibility that insight, that direct apprehension, can transcend conceptual understanding, just thinking. And a very radical compassion from the Bodhisattva ideal, wherein one has a genuine sense that others are just as important as oneself. Not as a thing you ought to do, not as a self-sacrifice, but just if you can let go of that strong protective sense of self, then of course others matter. So compassion just comes out naturally from that process. Radical compassion. And similarly, metta, love can be cultivated. Not just enjoy. You just tell somebody you ought to be a nicer person, you ought to be kinder. You realize there are methods, the metta bhavana and so on, to cultivate love. And similarly, there are methods to be more aware, mindfulness. You know, it's not just you should be awake, you should be more awake, but no, you can cultivate it. And finally, the final contribution on this sort of psychological level, it seems to me, is the contrast between the Sangha and the group. The group is so powerful in our society, the social groupings that we all belong to. And I think one can tend to think that either I have to be conforming within my workplace or within my political party or whatever group it happens to be, or I need to be isolated on my own. And to realize that there's a middle way, that you can be a genuinely independently thinking person who is able to think for yourself, is not dependent on others, but yet you can also be involved in a network. And it's an ideal. I'm not saying it always works, but that's the ideal of Sangha. That you are in connection with people, you're not isolated, but yet you're also genuinely authentic and being yourself and not just conforming. So that's in the area of spirituality, in the area of the mind, in the area of psychology. It's not the only place where Buddhism is relevant. Next week, Jnanavacha will be looking at physics and materialism and so on. Where Buddhism can develop an alternative view also of the brain, the way the brain interacts with the mind. And I hope we will be having stuff on arts and literature as well. Buddhist art is already being exposed to westernization, which I think is very interesting. There are some American artists who are Tibetan Buddhists, and they just do Tibetan art. which simply means copying rather beautifully the traditional, very fixed Tibetan forms. But personally, I'm not really keen on that. I think, you know, I mean, I'm not a painter or an artist myself, but I think if I was, I would not want to simply follow an Eastern form. I would want to allow that to influence, allow my knowledge of Eastern or of Buddhist mythology and imagery to influence my Western practice of art. So I think that's a very interesting area as well. So do look at the work of painters, of musicians, of poets, even architects. You look at this building, this is a Buddhist architect, or one Buddhist and one non-Buddhist architect, but definitely a Buddhist influence on, in a small way, on architecture. And that's going to be amazing when that starts to happen more. So I'm really excited about how Buddhism will be changed by its encounter with the West and how it will influence the West and change the West. There'll also be social adaptation. So a little bit more about that in a minute. But, you know, you could see this thing that we're trying to pioneer here about saying you can be a serious Buddhist without necessarily being a nun or a monk. In some Eastern Buddhist countries, there is that definite sense that if you're really going for it, you have to wear the robes, give up family life, and so on. So there are these social adaptations that may or may not be right, may or may not work. The danger with all this is appropriation. One of the dangers is appropriation, that Buddhist ideas and Buddhist images may just simply be taken on board by Western consumerist capitalist culture and just be used to sort of bolster it all. And I think that that could easily happen. It's symbols, concepts, terms, images, and so on, and practices being co-opted just in the service of business as usual. Things going on exactly as before, but with a slightly different look. Buddhas in advertising and that kind of thing. And this is appropriation of Buddhism. So I've got a little quotation on this from another American scholar I really admire called David Loy, who I recommend. He wrote a book called Money, Sex, War, Karma, which is about money, sex, war, and karma, and it's well worth reading. He says, will Buddhism itself be commodified and co-opted into a self-help stress reduction program that doesn't challenge institutional dukkha, in other words, suffering or stress, but adapts to it, reproducing capitalism's image of the consumer as atomism, as atomized and isolated? Or will the modernization of Buddhism open up new perspectives and new possibilities that challenge us to transform ourselves and our societies more profoundly? So that's what he wants, is that second one. But the first one may happen. It is a risk. The other thing, it seems to me, at least the thing to watch out for as we watch Buddhism affecting the West, is some of our own weaknesses as Westerners. I'm sure we don't have the same weaknesses, all of us, but I think there are particular things you can find. And I'll mention some of them that I've just came to mind. One of them is the tendency towards guilt and conformism. Which is, you know, very strong for us, I think. And the other side of that, which is individualism, which is also a form of conformism in a way, defining yourself in relation to you know, the ideology of a particular group. And then also materialism, consumerism, and the belief that nothing really matters apart from immediate gratification. And connected with that, the need for stimulation, the need for change, the need for intense experiences, which has become an addiction for many of us, I think, in the West. And it makes it very difficult at times to meditate, to go away on a retreat, to lead a simple life. And the tendency to isolation, people to be lonely and separate from each other. Our natural suspicion of ideologies and groups, which is justified, but also has the risk that we don't want, when we find a group that may be, to some extent, okay, we feel very slow to commit to it. Because we think, oh, hang on, watch this, you know. Literalism, I've already mentioned. The fear of being definite, I think. I think this is what I think of as being a form of liberalism, where one doesn't really want to say for sure, actually, that is not a good thing to do, you know. One wants to sort of be, in a way, incorporate everybody. Say, oh, everybody's fine, everybody's all right, you know. Western triumphalism is another thing, and I think this can be very insidious. We don't quite realize it. But probably most of us, although we may be very liberal, underneath we think that the Western way of doing things is definitely more progressive. It's definitely got much better. You know, and we can be a little bit patronizing if we visit Thailand or say, oh, they're lovely here, aren't they? You know. Another area is a twofold area is patriarchy and feminism. You know, I think both of those are interesting Western tendencies. The tendency for patriarchal domination and the response to that from feminism, which is another very interesting area. The whole thing of globalization is an issue here, where one's trying to make the whole planet more and more uniform. And I think that can be a problem for Buddhism coming here. Relativism, which is connected with liberalism. I won't go into that, actually. And also, the last one I wrote down is lack of contemplative knowledge. In other words, not realizing that somebody who's done a lot of meditation over a long period may have a very strong and valid intuitive sense of what is the case and what isn't. And we may overstress the value of step-by-step argument in coming to a conclusion, not realizing that contemplation over a long period gives you a different source of genuine cognition, genuine knowledge. And the last thing I want to say, thanks for your patience, the last thing I want to say is something about how Buddhism can integrate into Western society. And I'm taking some of these ideas from Sangharakshita. So if you look up on Free Buddhist Audio, Integration of Buddhism into Western Society, there's an interesting talk on that. Some people will want to preserve what they see as a pure Buddhism, but there's no such thing as pure Buddhism. There isn't even a pure Burmese Buddhism or a pure Thai Buddhism or a pure Tibetan Buddhism. It just doesn't work that way. It's misguided, I think. The Buddhism that's practiced in a particular Eastern country is not just a crystal or a fossil that is just like that. Everything, of course, as Buddhism teaches, everything evolves, everything changes all the time. And it's changing as it encounters the West. You can't just stick that fossil on your mental pace in Bayswater and think, oh good, I've got Buddhism now. So let's rejoice in Buddhism melding and integrating with Western culture. It's a really fascinating time to be alive as we watch that happening. So for it to integrate in a genuine way, a helpful way, these are the things that we need, according to Sangharakshita, which are maybe slightly unexpected, but very interesting. The first is that for Buddhism to integrate into Western culture, the level of consciousness of at least some people in the West needs to go up. There needs to be more awareness, more mindfulness, more compassion through practice of meditation and also through indirect methods. In other words, there needs to be real practice of Buddhism and real fruits of that practice, not amongst everybody, but amongst some people. You can't just bring the ideas in without the reality of doing it. But also, for it to integrate, things about Western society would need to change, at least in small pockets, so that the conditions are more conducive. You know, it's very difficult to practice Buddhism in the midst of the bombardment that is modern culture, the expectations of work, the time you're expected to spend, the crucialness of money, the pressure of ideologies on us and so on. So I think some things need to change. And that's why I would say that if we can get some things like Buddhist communities going where people are living together as Buddhists, Buddhist businesses going where people are working together as Buddhists, those are what I mean by the pockets of different conditions in Western society. And I hope that a Buddhist center like this can do that to some extent, can be a little bit of an oasis where it's a little bit easier to practice Buddhism. So we need to try and do that as well. And then we also need to introduce genuine Buddhist ideas, which means learning to understand Buddhism and bring those ideas into our own fields, of interest. And then it also means that an integration which happens on our own level, in our individual level. We are, most of us, I think, Westerners, and we have a very strong influence from Western culture. I think we need to value that, treasure it, see how important that is, and allow it to meet Buddhism and see what happens, not keep them in separate compartments. And that'll, I think, make all the difference.